This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Today, first of all, welcome to the Waleed bin Talal Center for Muslim Christian Understanding. And I think that we still have this new, Georgetown has a new policy, which is that if you come in, it's not just us, Georgetown, if you come into this room or any other room where a presentation is happening, you are waving, you are giving permission to be recorded in Q&A. So if you ask, used to be, you could ask a ridiculous question, speaker could give an abusive answer, and none of this would be recorded. Now it will be recorded and may be presented on
something
like that.
So
it
can't be abusive?
No, you can. You just will face the consequences.
What if I get abusive with you?
Yes, you can. That's fine. I don't mind. So our speaker today, I'm very happy to have him here. I met Jim when I went to teach at the University of Washington, where he teaches. And I was there for 4 years, and Jim was my colleague, and we met. Well, first when I went to interview, but then when we were in Uzbekistan, you don't get to say this often, I met Jim on the road from Tashkent to Samarkand. That's where I met Jim.
We kind of shared our life stories.
Yeah, it was a long trip. He's the head of the master's program in religion. What is it?
The chair of comparative religion.
That's it. I was on this program, but I can't remember what the name of it was. The chair. Chair of the Comparative Religion Program in the Jackson School of International Relations, which is actually as close, I think, as any other school has to as equivalent to the SFS. I mean, these two programs are very similar. They're both sort of giant departments that are actually schools. And so he's in the Jackson School of International Relations at University of Washington. He's an associate professor there. And he
full
did
professor.
Full professor?
Yeah.
We have to. How did that happen?
Just came on.
Wow, through merit? That's great. Rest.
I gave a gift to the
Okay, full professor, which is excellent. And he has he did his PhD at the Divinity School, University of Chicago. And he has written several books, one of them on, I think, mega churches in the Pacific Northwest, and one on, a recent one on Robert Bell, a very prominent American evangelical pastor, I guess you'd say. So I had the idea of having him come and speak when I was in Seattle last year, and we were talking about kind of the similarities between Muslim, I don't know what you call them, evangelists and American Christian evangelists. And so we thought we'd talk about them in the same setting. So I won't waste any more time, and I'll just welcome Jim and have him give his presentation.
Great. Thanks, Jonathan. Really, really happy to be here, and a couple of my former students are here, and it's really lovely to see them, and it's great to be at Georgetown. So what I'm going to do today is give you a little sense. This Rob Bell and A New American Christianity just came out. I'm right now working on High on God, how megachurches conquered America. And, pardon me? And a part of what I'm going to talk about today comes from the research I'm doing right now on those megachurches. There are 12 national megachurches, and you can really argue now that megachurches are the way Americans are doing their religion. In fact, 50% of all Americans who go to church go to the top 10% largest churches in America. So this is a huge phenomenon. Some say it's slowing down, but the surveys show that it's not. And they're continuing to grow in size and in number. There's 1,800 megachurches presently in America. And they're really flourishing across the globe now. So this is really the way the Christian church is going. Today I'm just going to talk about charisma, whether it's positive or negative. What is the charismatic impulse, some examples, a few explanations, and a little bit of a case study on megachurch pastors. So does that sound good? Are you guys ready to go? Good. I love this quote. Ernst Bloch is one of the great Marxist philosophers of the 20th century and talked a great deal about utopia and the impulse for utopia. And in reading him and in thinking about megachurches, I thought, that's it.
Do you mind if I close the door?
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry about that.
And I thought this quote was beautiful, and that says, the path leads via the little waking dreams, the strong ones, via the wavering dreams that can be abused to the rigorous ones, via shifting castles in the air to the one thing that is outstanding and needful. The final will is to be truly present so that the lived moment belongs to us and we to it, and stay a while could be said of it. So here it is. Man wants at last to enter the here and now as himself, wants to enter his full life without postponement and distance. So there's a sense, I think there's a real sense in which megachurches, and I'll give you a quote from one of our megachurch members. This is what the megachurch member said. I cannot wait to go back to my megachurch because it is like a drug. And I can't wait for the next hit. Okay? And what we found in these thousand or so interviews is an enormous passion and joy and a sense that people are finally finding who they truly are. So this really is an explosion of ecstatic joy that people find in these megachurches. So where does this come from? How does this get constructed? And I think what Jonathan and I are going to talk about a little bit about is charismatic leadership and how does charisma get constructed. Has anybody seen this movie, Kamari? Oh, my gosh. Okay, everybody has homework. Go home, rent Kamari. You guys haven't seen Charles? Oh, my gosh. I mean, oh, you got to see it. He is a New Jersey-born American who is of Indian descent, obviously, and he wants to do films, and he realizes that people are attracted to yogis and yoga gurus in America. And then he gets the idea, I'll become a guru, and I'll film my transformation into a guru, and I'll show how guruship works. And that's exactly what this movie is about. And it's very disturbing because literally people begin to follow him. Kumari is totally made up. His yoga moves are completely fabrications. His philosophy is just a little bit of self-help. And you have people literally coming to him as if he's a Shri, a guru. And bowing to him and saying to him, I cannot believe you've come into my house.
And made up name or what?
Everything. The whole thing is made up. It is shocking. At first I thought, oh my God, this is terrible. Because it, you know, it's full on manipulation. But this is really interesting. His main point is that everyone can be their own guru. I am a fake. And because he says that, they all find him very sincere. Anyway, you got to see the movie. Okay, next one. This is my friend Rob Bell, who's become a best-selling author, started a megachurch. On day one, had 1,000 members coming. In a year and a half, he had 10,000 people coming to his megachurch. Okay? Now, I want to show you what a charismatic personality looks like and how they...
Try unclicking the...
Uh-oh.
Go to press the Microsoft Explorer icon, maybe?
Here we go.
At the very beginning of the National Book Tour, the book is entitled What We Talk About When We Talk About God. So
this is not the charismatic figure.
We want to hear you talk to us about what you talk about when you talk about God.
This is Rob Bell.
going on? How you doing? How far can I walk into the crowd before that thing starts making that high-pitched sound that makes me have to put my lightsaber away? Oh, I can come this far. Excellent. Where are you? Who are you people? Where are you from? You from here, Nashville? Birmingham? Birmingham, Alabama? Kentucky? Knoxville? Florida? You didn't come to Florida just for this. You did. All right, that's really inspiring or kind of stalkerish. I'm not sure. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit. All right. Wow. All right. Well, it's great to be with you. My name is Rob, and I live in California, which is to the left. And I met my wife freshman year, first or second week of school on a tennis court in college. We were both 18. Just saying. And we've been married for 18 years, and it's just amazing. And I have a 14-year-old son who is a rapper. And I have a 12-year-old son who is a skater. And then I have a 3-year-old daughter who is a princess. And I actually think she's a princess. Like, there's some sort of developmental stage where you haven't yet got irony. So you're like, no, seriously, I'm a princess. And you just sort of, excellent, whatever you'd like. And so I write books and make films and come to Nashville. And it's the third thing I do with my life. I visit Nashville, and in that order, and I have a new book out called What We Talk About When We Talk About God a couple of years ago. My fifth book was called Love Wins, and that came out this week in a version for like junior high and high school students. You've got to shape them early. And then my friend Carlton, he wrote and produced a show called Lost. Are there any Lost fans? And he and I are developing a show, and it's really amazing. It's coming along, and hopefully in the next little while you get to see what we've been cooking on. If you sort of take Lost and you take some of the work I've done with sermons and books and films and live events and Q&A, and you put it all in a blender and threw in a little, maybe some TED Talks, some Peter Rollins, maybe some Letterman and some Colbert, and you put it in a blender. Hopefully it come out with the thing that we're working on, and we're really, really excited about it. And then most importantly, I try to surf every day, and I have not surfed today because I've been in Nashville. So if I start twitching partway through the talk, it's because my gills are drying up. So that's a bit about me, and then there's you. And so I'd like to talk a bit to you about God, and we'll see where that takes us. And I kind of know where we're headed, and I kind of don't, and that's when it gets interesting, you know what I mean? And then maybe we'll take some time for questions at the end, and then we'll see where that takes.
Okay. That's it. How do I get this back to...
go down to click this thing here. That's what I would do. I don't know how to use these things anymore. Oh, you know what? Go to up on the top. So... From current slide, left side. Press that one.
Current slide.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, that's Rob Bell. So you know, kind of, you know, that's not a great example of charisma, but it's he's got it all going on, and we'll talk about that. Power of Charisma, Ling Hongzhi. Does anybody recognize him? The founder of Falun Gong, and really a movement within China, which, of course, in 1999, China kicked him out and tried to stop it. And really it became that big of a movement that Chinese government was very concerned about it. And here is an American U.S. mathematical statistician talking about Hongzhi. Undeniably, Master Li has supernatural powers. But he doesn't show them, he doesn't display them. He has gotten permission, put that word into quotes, from the higher world to do what he does. You cannot do that without permission. He would be killed. The fact that he has been able to do this shows that he has support from above. Okay, so this is the kind of the construction of the charismatic figure. Charismatic authority, of course, developed initially by Max Weber. And the three ingredients that you'll always find within charismatic figure is a display of exceptional abilities. Usually they have kind of a sense of humor, rhetorical ability, an ability just to display and also to get attention, the abilities of thought that is said to be divinely inspired, and there is a bond. There's a charismatic bond. And so these features of charismatic figures are always there. And the construction of the charismatic figure is a bond. You can't be charismatic unless you have a following. And that is really essential. So no one is a charismatic figure on their own. It is always in relationship to a group or an audience. And kind of the sociological context for the charismatic bond is really critical here. First, this is interesting because Rob Bell started his church in 1999, and it really got going in 2001. And one of the events, of course, in 2001 was 9/11. And so there was great stress in the culture and in the society, and he became deeply empathic with that stress, with that controversy, with that conflict. And that is what a charismatic bond is built on, a sense in which the leader understands the situation of the culture, and in some sense, in understanding it, has solved it themselves. There's a way, and think about charismatic figures in your own life, and you'll think to yourself, they understand the problems and the issues I am dealing with. And in some form or another, you get the sense that they have solved it, that they have reached a conclusion that is something that you can go along with. And once you get that feeling, the feeling within you, I've seen followers of charismatic figures, and I was telling Jonathan this, literally when they come into the presence of the charismatic figure, their faces change, they become more alive, they feel like, home. And there's a felt sense of lack in social circumstance, and a deep sense that the leader understands and has solved the problem, and really begins to act as a proxy. Now, there's some psychological work that has been done to explain the charismatic bond, and you know, I'm not a psychologist; I'm more a sociologist, but there's something to this. That is, when followers come into the presence of the one who has solved their problems, there's a sense of fulfillment. I was telling Jonathan this, too, the other day. Rob Bell has become a friend of mine. Okay? And so he came to Seattle, gave a book reading. We sat down, had breakfast, and he was telling me about his television show. And it was a two-hour conversation, and he's the kind of guy that you want to listen to. He's telling me a plot of a new book that he just thought of, and he's going on and on about that, and he's asking me a few questions, although charismatic figures really like the attention on themselves. And right at the end of our breakfast together, he takes the scarf and starts to wrap it around his neck. Okay, just like that. And right in front of my eyes, and I don't know what was going on here, but I suddenly said to myself, oh my God, he is a Hollywood figure. And he seemed to kind of transform right in front of me. So was it me or was it him? Was it me or was it him? Okay, so this bond or this relationship is very powerful. And I think many academicians have been incredibly suspicious of it for good reason, right? But of course, academicians sometimes are charismatic figures themselves and use that charisma for their own needs and wants and desires. So it's kind of sketchy sometimes. What's also interesting is the study of charisma is not very well developed. And the study now is really kind of sunk into new religious movement leaders, what are called cults. And so most of the charismatic studies are done on destructive figures or people that everyone thinks is a problem. But what I'm trying to do with this megachurch study is to say, no, charisma is everywhere. Charisma is everywhere, and it has positive ingredients within it. And here's one of those, a nice quote by Len Oakes. And he wrote a book that's in the 1990s, but I think it's an excellent book called Prophetic Charisma. And he says it can be said that the great work that this great work involves a creative process by which followers use the charismatic relationship with the leader and the rest of the group to test themselves, transcend themselves, and experience love. The disciplined sacrifice of the self to the will of the leader and the group is an instrumental part of this quest. That's interesting. So I think there's charismatic bonds and charismatic relationships going on all the time in our lives, with mentors, with political figures, with religious figures, and it can be intensely creative. But it also can be dangerous, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. This is one of the best, I think, theorists of charismatic bond and also of interactive ritual chains is Randall Collins. And what he says is that any group gathering takes on or can take on a collective effervescence. And leaders evoke and harness this emotional energy, and symbols are poured in to create the group identity. And people then desire to repeat it. Okay? One of the things that you find in studying megachurches is that there's intense emotional energy within these worship services. And I'll give you an example. I was down at a church in San Diego called Rock Church. Miles McPherson, ex-NFL player, African-American man, kind of an intensely handsome man, and a great speaker. And I'm down there to, basically do research. And I'm writing notes, and I'm sitting through four of his services, and each one of them is the same. They're beautiful services, about 3,000 people, 4,000 people at each service. And there's an altar call, okay? There's an altar call. And in the third service, I'm sitting there writing notes, and it's in the middle of the altar call, and I literally feel my body, literally, saying to me, I'm going forward. I'm literally having an out-of-body experience of my body saying, we are walking down to the altar. And I'm literally going like this, going, what are you saying? trying to be a good sociologist, I said, no, we are not walking down to the altar. And I sort of call this energy back into my head, and it stopped. Okay? And I didn't know that was going to happen. So that emotional energy of a charismatic leader is very real. It's very real. It's empirically real. Okay. Charismatic leaders are these energy stars. And that's too long. I don't want to do that. Yeah, I'm going to move on. Okay, so to megachurches. My study on megachurches is to study kind of normal charisma. Is there such a thing as normal charisma? And what would normal charisma, not cult leaders, but kind of normal charisma that may be positive and creative and helpful to people? And so that's what I'm doing with this. Charismatic leaders in new religious movements or cults, and I don't really like to call them cults, but some people do. These leaders tend to be the voice of God. They will say, Jim Jones and others will say, I am the voice of God. Institutionalized religion, these leaders will say they're instrument of God's will in the world. And that's what a megachurch pastor says, right? So a distinction might be messianic charismatic leaders like Jim Jones have the power to do this. Do y'all remember this? 1,000 people commit suicide at his command. And if you go online, you can hear him speaking as they are killing themselves and their children. And it's very dramatic. He's clearly a charismatic leader. prophetic leadership who is an instrument of God's will, right? Billy Graham, I think, is a great example. I was telling Jonathan, if you see Billy Graham early in his career, he's an intensely handsome guy, and he's incredibly dynamic as a speaker. Yeah, as he got older, he got kind of blessed in that dynamic. But here it is. So he's not leading them into suicide and into conversion. All right. What I find with megachurch pastors in the comments about pastors is that they say this. They say this kind of thing. He's no different than you and I. That's what we love about it. So the data set comes from 12 nationally representative megachurches, 283 leaders, lay leaders, and new members, and 270 references to leadership qualities of the pastor. And here they are. The senior pastor, now read these. These are quotes by megachurch members. The senior pastor is a walking reincarnation of Christ. Just, he'd walk up to you and just shake your hand and put his arm around you, not knowing him, and all of a sudden Jesus was just like overflowing out of this guy's pores. You don't get that in any other church. Like to me, he had this special anointing over him, which has created a special anointing over the church. So I just said, I had to be a part of it. So in some sense, they feel these pastors are incredibly exceptional. Another said, because he's human, an edge will stick out sometimes. And he steps back and he submits to the Lord. And that just really garners a lot of respect from us. He's very self-aware of how he's wired and his limitation. He even asked us to pray for him about certain things that he's working through. And then another said, I mean the senior pastor's name, from the pulpit will say, I cheated on an exam. I got caught and my fiancé found out and it confronted me. I mean, he's not hiding. He's not trying to be like, I'm the perfect pastor. And if you're like me, you can go to heaven. He's just saying, you know, what, I messed up this week or whatever. Then another said, he makes sure, though, that he tells us all the time, look at this, how much he loves us. In doing my research on Rob Bell, I listened to 100 sermons and transcribed them. And in one sermon, it was early in his career, he says this to 3,500 people, he says this. Hello, my best friends. Right? Hello, my best friends. All right. Senior pastor is God's mouthpiece. And when your mouthpiece goes forth with such passion, you can feel his heart. It goes forth with so much energy, it's hard to see into somebody with every ounce of who they are pour out that much, and you walk away. What happens is spiritual transformation. You can't see somebody just pouring out with every fiber of their being and not be affected. Okay, so these charismatic leadership, negative or positive? Is it negative or positive? And Jonathan and I are going to talk about that. My sense, you know, and this is kind of early in my thinking on this, is that the negative is when a pastor is not transparent and manipulates for their own benefits and keeps all the power for themselves. And the examples I'm giving here are kind of the obvious ones. Ted Haggard. Do you all know this one? Know this pastor? He was a Colorado megachurch pastor up until, I think, 2006 or 2007. He was the president of the National Association of Evangelical Churches. It was said that he was on the telephone on Mondays with George W. Bush every Monday, giving him spiritual advice. But in the midst of his ministry, he was going to see a masseuse in Denver, and a male masseuse, and, you know, it was more than massage. And it was found out, and he had to step down. Jimmy Swaggart, probably one of my favorite megachurch pastors. So anyone of you guys remember him from the past?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
He was very dynamic.
Did he get caught twice?
Yeah, no, he repented, and this is a picture of him repenting. This is a picture of him repenting of his sex with the prostitute. But he couldn't stop himself. He just kept going back. But I looked it up. He still has a ministry. And he's like 80 years old. He looks pretty good still. And here's Jimmy Baker. Tammy Baker's my favorite. Jimmy's pretty good too. But of course, Jimmy got caught with his secretary. I think they were embezzling funds. Tammy goes on to be kind of a celebrity of her own, becomes kind of a favorite of the gay culture in the 1980s and 90s, which is kind of weird, but interesting. And Jimmy Baker's got a show again. He's got no hair, but he's got a show again. So he went to prison, and he came back. So it happens. And here, this is the last slide. Positive. Perhaps they're more transparent, offering transformed lives and principles for transformation and empower others. Here's Rick Warren. You know, I have many students in Seattle at the University of Washington who've, you know, been a part of his church, and they're very dynamic, healthy people. Bill Heibel's Willow Creek Association has built up a ministry in Chicago, which many people think is a wonderful church. And Joel Osteen. Has anybody listened to Joel Osteen? Raise your hand.
He's great.
All right. You know, he's the classic prosperity gospel minister. And I was saying to Jonathan that he's just not that bright. But it fits well, because he gives very simple sermons. He basically says this. My wife likes him and likes to listen to his sermons because it makes her feel good and gives her hope. And he starts every sermon with a joke, and everybody laughs. And then he has a little ritual with his Bible. And then he says, you know, I'm going to basically give you about four positive tips of how you can be successful in life. And then he says, I know a lot of you think this won't work. And then he goes to show how it works in four different examples. And it's as simple as that. It's a formulaic process that really, really works. So is that bad or good? I don't, what do you guys?
Good.
Yeah, anyway, so that's it. Jonathan, you wanna?
Yeah, I mean, that's, thanks, Jim. I was, maybe I should find a clip to play you all too. Although, I probably have to think of someone who was speaking English. Let's see here. So this is just, I'm just going to pick some random clip. So, this is American Muslim scholar who's a convert to Islam, originally from Greek, mostly Greek kind of immigrant background. His name's Hamza Yusuf. I'm even more than Jim. I'm friends with him, and I have a lot of respect for him co-founder of one of the first Muslim college in the United States. So I have a lot of respect for him. So I have no idea what I'm going to pick. We'll just have to hope that it's not bad. If it is, then I apologize.
I would now like to invite one of the most respected scholars of our generation, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf.
He's American.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم تسليما كثيرا. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. الحمد لله. من الله سبحانه وتعالى إن شاء الله bless this gathering and give us the angelic presence إن شاء الله and keep our hearts united. I إن شاء الله talk about a few things. One of them is about a hadith that is related.
Let's go.
On him, according to the hadith, is shaheed. So we have a different worldview, and we have to incorporate this worldview constantly in how we view things.
that we believe that we live in a benevolent universe. We believe in Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. All of the Quranic surahs begin with Bismillah Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. And so we believe that Allah is Rahmah, and that He sent His Prophet as a Rahmah. وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَاكَ إِلَّا رَحْمَةً لِلْعَالَمِينَ. We sent you as a mercy to all the world. We believe He was a mercy to the Christians. He was a mercy.
Okay, so that's just a short example of Hamza Yusuf speaking. I think actually when one of the most interesting things about him and as you can see different, actually different streams of oratory coming together. You can see African-American Muslim oratory. You think about Malcolm X speaking, you can see he's kind of channeling Malcolm X in a way. And also the way that Muslim scholars in places like Egypt will speak with hand gestures like this and like that, a very specific kind of way of moving hands that is does not come from American tradition. I see my old professor, Dr. Majid Fakhri here, dawn of Islamic philosophy. It's great to have him here. So I was, when I was in Egypt last year, I just was walking on the street and I found this book in one of the sidewalk book stalls. It's called Dua fil Manfa, Preachers Who Have in Exile, Preachers in Exile. So it's a kind of a hatchet job on a set of very popular, it's called Dua, which is a plural of Da'iyah. It's a, I would say preacher, evangelist is another good word, but it's people who are calling people to Islam. And that when I say that, you'd think that it means calling them to, you know, non-Muslims to Islam, but really you're calling Muslims to be more Muslim, to better practice, better guidance. But that's the same word that would be used for calling non-Muslims to become Muslim. So I'll just call them preachers, and but I think evangelist is a very good translation as well. So just a brief history. I'll focus on Egypt because it's a very kind of concentrated example, and at least in the Arab world, it kind of is the center of this sort of activity, even if the people are not from Egypt. But there's also preachers in other Muslim countries, especially Indonesia, Malaysia, Pakistan, have kind of rich tradition of evangelists. If we look back in, let's say, to the early part of the 20th century, you don't really have separate class of Muslims who are preachers. So the people who are effective preachers who get big audiences are Muslim scholars. And for those of you who don't have background here, you can think of like a rabbi as a very good example. A Muslim scholar is like a rabbi. So they're a religious figure in the sense that they play a role in, their main job is studying religion, but they're a scholar, not a priest or a minister. Their primary job is to kind of learn, process, and then put out sacred knowledge about God's law, the Sharia, about the right way to be Muslim, about the correct way to live as a Muslim and obey God. So that's sort of the, when I say Muslim scholars, that's what I'm talking about. So they're Muslim scholars who happen to be very good speakers and happen to get audiences. So if you look at, let's say, Egypt in the 1970s and 1980s, you have figures like Abdul Hamid Kishk, Muhammad Mutawalli Sharawi, who are, they're clerics, they're religious scholars who just happen to develop or kind of attract huge audiences at their mosques where they serve as imams. Or later, just in the case of Mutawalli Sharawi, he went on TV, he was the minister of religious endowments in Egypt. He was invited on TV for a show one time. He did a really great job, and then he kept going, and he was probably the most beloved preacher in Egypt, and he had a weekly show about the Quran and daily life. Abdul Hamid Kish was much very different. He was very political. During the days of Sadat and Mubarak in the 70s and 80s, he would give sermons that were directly challenging kind of the status quo in Egypt, the powers that be, he had gigantic audiences at his mosque. You could not get into his mosque on Friday unless you went there, you know, after the dawn prayer and just stayed there all day. The buildings around the mosque became nothing but audience areas for his sermons. Eventually, he was banned in the 80s from preaching, and he just was put under house arrest. He was also tortured, by the way, like many Muslim scholars. Politically active Muslim scholars in the 20th century were tortured in prison under Sadat, under Mubarak. He was political. Mutawalli Sharawi was not political. He was decidedly, committedly apolitical, never talked about politics, which is, of course, a political decision and has political ramifications. So his popularity and his ability to continue preaching on television was, in a way, predicated on not being a threat to the established elite and government system in Egypt. He died in the late 90s. And a lot of this generation of these very big scholars who were religious scholars who found that they were also charismatic speakers, they died in the late 1990s. And what happened in the mid-1990s until really 2010, 2011, is a phenomenon that is often referred to as Du'a al-Judud, or the new preachers, the new generation of preachers. These were different because most of them were not religious scholars in the sense that they had been through madrasa training, they had graduated from seminaries like Al-Azhar, they hadn't been through the Sharia training, the classical Sharia training would give someone the right to call themselves one of the ulama, one of the Muslim scholarly class. They were lay people who had acquired some Islamic knowledge and were excellent at presenting. And they did so through first by speaking in local mosques, then by a lot of times getting satellite television shows on the new satellite television channels like Dream TV, like ART in the Arab world, Al Jazeera in some cases, and also through selling books, selling tapes, and eventually online stuff. So they did not wear the kind of robes of an Azhar scholar, which would be a long black gown with a red turban, fez with a white turban wrapped around it. They wore suits and ties to show they were part of a normal person. And their message was, we're speaking as lay Muslims, to lay Muslims, showing how Islam is lived in daily life. Now, what are some of the characteristics of these new preachers? They're not political. They are decidedly not political. Now, this is a very interesting problem because if you lived in Egypt until 2011, right? There are two kind of overwhelming realities in life. One is poverty and corruption. So corruption caused by poverty caused by corruption, an incredibly corrupt economic political system that's sort of crony capitalist, that rewards people who are close to a dictatorial regime and dispossesses basically the rest of society, who's forced to scrounge to survive. That's one reality. The second reality is that dictatorial system, which cannot be challenged, which cannot even be close to challenge, which cannot be hinted at in a challenging way. So the new preachers only speak outside of those areas. And I at least felt, listening to them, that there is always, it's like a giant, what is it, elephant in the room or gorilla in the room, whatever the big animal in the room that you use in this metaphor, that it's there and it's always present. Now, what did that mean? It meant that they talked about spiritual issues. How do you embody or manifest Islamic values Islamic character in your daily life? How do you how to be inspired by God and the Prophet Muhammad? How to be inspired by the example of the early Muslims? How to deal with social challenges, like a lot of times encouraging women to wear a headscarf, encouraging men not to, you know, have girlfriends, things like that. So how do you deal with social issues like this? And of another characteristic was charisma. And in the Islamic idiom, charisma can be talked about in several ways. One of them is the idea of barakah. Barakah, you may recognize the word from Barack Obama. So barakah is means blessedness. Sort of, it's almost like one scholar calls it the stuff of faith. It's like a glow, a halo around somebody. But it sort of is communicated by touch. You can be near it. You can feel it. It's like an aroma coming off them. Barakah is blessedness. It's channeling the sacred stuff of God and the Prophet. And that just marks you. Now, with these lay preachers, some of them are decidedly, they're presenting themselves as non-barakah bearers. They're not saints. They're not Sufi mystics. They're saying, I'm a regular guy. But clearly, barakah is part of their appeal. Their appeal is, as Jim said, they have solved a problem. They don't say this, but what they're you know, I don't want to, you know, get into commercial transactions too overtly, but they're selling a product, and that product is, I'm going to tell you how to understand your religion in a way that's authentic and real and makes sense in this world today, and it's going to solve the big problem. What is the big problem for Muslims? How do I believe that my religion is the correct religion, and how do I know how to follow it correctly when the world is based on the idea that, one, religion is passé and stupid, and two, Islam is a terrible religion that's violent and awful, and three, that in my own society, I'm really unable to have any power. So I don't have any agency. My civilization is looked down upon. Religion is looked down upon in general. And yet I'm supposed to feel like what I'm doing is true and right. And what the preacher who is successful, I think, convinces the audience of is that preacher is really somehow gotten it. They've understood the real Islam that's going to save Muslims today. And that has a huge appeal. And I don't think that's, I'm not trying to say that's manipulative or dishonest or disingenuous. I don't think that is. But I think that's what people are looking for in these preachers. Even if they don't know that's what they're looking for, that's what convinces them. And you can't remove this from the context of Islam versus the West, colonized versus colonizer, or, you know, imperial victim versus imperialist force. It's all part of that equation. And what I think is what's very interesting is that since the day the Arab Spring started, you haven't heard about any of these guys. I would, unless someone disagrees with me, people who study the region or from the region, I would contend that until before the Arab Spring, these figures were in the media a lot. They're very, very prominent. And I'll give you some examples of Egypt. Amr Khalid. Khalid al-Gindi. Mustafa, I forgot his last name. Mustafa Hosni, I think is his name. I was on his TV show once. I was actually on his pilot, which is really weird. I didn't realize that too much later. And another one who's kind of a different figure, a Yemeni scholar named Habib Ali al-Jifri. And so these people were in the media a lot. They had a lot of attention, not just in the, you know, Arab media, but in the Western media. And The second the Arab Spring happened, you don't hear about them anymore. And I think one of the reasons is that they had thrived by speaking in these spaces around the giant object that no one could talk about. Suddenly you can talk about that object, and people are getting in real debates about how society should be structured, about how the future, political, social future of the country should be built, and they're no longer really relevant. And suddenly real issues have been opened up. I don't think that means that what they were doing before is false or was an illusion or anything. I simply think that the world in which they thrived had ceased to, its main features had been obliterated. What are some of the, when you talk about, you know, positives or negatives, this book is really interesting because it's just such a perfect example of a guy who is just deeply, deeply suspicious of religious authorities, who's deeply suspicious of the commodification of religion. So one of the things you'll often hear when people are critical of these preachers is that they've commodified religion, that they are selling things, that they're and that they're getting rich off it, that they're benefiting. You know, they brand, turn themselves into a brand, and they sell themselves, and they're using religion to do that. Now, some of them, for example, the Indonesian preacher Abdullah Jimmy Astiar, he's very open about that. He's almost a sort of explicit of gospel of prosperity, where he says, "Look how much money I have. Look how what I'm worth. You know, this is because of my faith." You can do that too. Others are always insisting that they're actually not making any money, that they don't accept any money, that this is all good, you know, charitable actions, they're doing it for the sake of God alone. And then later, you know, it's found out that they have X amount of money in some bank account or Y job with a certain company, and that they're hobnobbing with all these rich people. And so you have the kind of the same drama or maybe dramatic arc of the preacher who is torn down, or the fallen idol whose romantic life is uncovered. You know, he has a second wife, or he's having an affair, or, you know, he's takes sexual advantage of people who are or his followers, and that person falls, or that they're actually rich and that they're become a greedy person who's not pious anymore, and then that person falls. So that's part of the arc. It's set up for these people by, one, by themselves, and two, by their critics. Now, that gets to, I think, in the crux of the issue for me, which is there's always the hope, and what creates the appeal of every new preacher, who appears, is that they're the real deal, that they're legitimate, they're true, that they're not selling something, that they really are, they really have figured out the answers to life problems. They really are going to teach it authentically, and they're not going to disgrace themselves. And the problem is, how do you know if that's the case or not? How do you know if this person's another, will be a fallen idol, is a fraud, or is this person really someone that I trust, that I want to follow, that I want to allow to influence me? And when I was in graduate school and would go in the summers to Egypt, it was starting in 2001, it was actually exactly around the time that these figures were really getting big in Egypt. And I remember spring of 2002, going to Egypt, and all my friends in Egypt had gotten involved with Amr Khalid and in his production company for ART, which is a big satellite channel owned by a Saudi businessman. And they were all working on these different TV shows from their free time, because they believed, they really were devotees of Amr Khalid, and the women who hadn't worn headscarves had all started wearing headscarves. They had all become much more pious. And I remember feeling really this kind of electric excitement amongst these people about how this was really, Egypt was really becoming more pious because of people like Amr Khalid. And Amr Khalid was later, no one really knows what happened that I know of, but he left Egypt. And the question is, was he expelled by the Mubarak regime? Did he leave on his own? I don't really know the answer. But I think what happened to this group of people is not Amr Khalid, but the producer involved turned out to have married a second woman who was one of the women working on the project. And of course, everything just unraveled from there and spun out of control. And now, when I go in, I meet my friends. They're still good practicing Muslims. The women, a lot of Muslims still wear their headscarves. But there's that, you sort of, it's almost like you're seeing members of a rock band, after it imploded, after, someone brought their wife on the set or something like that. I mean, like the Beatles or something. It's just, you see these kind of people who are now older and wiser, and a bit more jaded. Not, I think, because of they're disappointed in Amr Khalid, but because they're sort of disappointed in this fact that this project fell victim to the same things that human relationships always fall victim to. Now, I would, and here I really have to kind of disclose all my feelings on the issue. So Habib Ali al-Jifri, who's another, I mentioned him, the Yemeni scholar, he was so popular in Egypt in the early 2000s. He still is very popular all over the Muslim world. And he comes from, his family comes from this valley in Yemen called the Hadramaut Valley, which is the sort of origin and seat of this Sufi order called the Ba'alawi or Alawiya Sufi order, which is spread throughout the Indian Ocean basin. So all the way in Malaysia, Indonesia, India, Yemen. And he never went to college. He just studied Islamically through the kind of classical tradition of Islamic education. And in the early 2000s, he became, and I'm not really sure how this happened, but he came to Egypt and started appearing in audiences with wealthy businessmen. What you see a lot of times with these preachers is that actors and actresses will go to them and become their followers, and the actresses will, give up appearing in romantic movies and start wearing a headscarf, and the actors will start only doing Islamically appropriate work. So they have a strong appeal amongst the elite, both the business elite and the kind of media elite. And then Habib Ali would appear on satellite TV channels and would go travel around the world, but he would still be based out of Tarim in Hadramaut, where he would teach some of the time at the madrasa there, and then also he would teach in Abu Dhabi. So I got to know Habib Ali as kind of randomly, as someone who was invited to some events where he was, and I got to know him over the years, and end up spending a significant amount of time with him on the road and in Tarim and other places in Egypt, in Abu Dhabi. And I have to say, I don't want to be accused of being naive or something, and I certainly don't think anybody's perfect. Nobody's infallible. Certainly Habib Ali is not infallible. But I have to say, there's lots of stuff in this book about why is he hanging out with all these rich people and who's paying for his trips and things like that. But he always says, his family is well off. His family owns a lot of land. And if he gets invited somewhere, they pay for his airline ticket and they put him in a hotel, like, professors when they go and speak places. But he doesn't, I've traveled with him in lots of different places, and he always has his entourage with him, not of lackeys, but people who are his, there's the driver and assistants and his friends and his students, and they'll all stay in the same hotel rooms and they'll all eat the same food. And in a lot of places, that food's not, I remember places in Yemen where just, rice and chicken in a styrofoam container, that was it. And, he sleeps and sometimes doesn't even sleep in his own room, sleeps with other people in the same room. And, in terms of his romantic life, he has Well, depending on when. I mean, he has 2 to 4 wives. And he just, you know, he'll be open about that. And he, guess that's his right as a Muslim man to do that. So that he's not, he doesn't marry people in secret and then people find out about it, because he just says, you know, yeah, I have 2 wives, or I have 3 wives. So I think in a way that transparency is, I mean, for me, it's always made me feel very comfortable around him. And I respect him a lot as a scholar. I respect him a lot I respect him a lot as just a, you know, as a good exemplar of how a Muslim should act. And I certainly don't think, I think the mistake would be to think that he's perfect and not susceptible to sins or mistakes. But I've never seen anything from him that would ever say that he would claim that. And I remember he said to me several times, you know, he says so many times, I've thought of just leaving Dawah, leaving this calling mission, and just going back to what. And I remember there was times where, I mean, it would be, the guy has an endless energy. I mean, he sleeps only a few hours. If you want to travel with him, you're not going to sleep at all. You know, and he, I remember he, it was about 2 a.m, we were at his house in Tarim. No, it was in Abu Dhabi. And he said, how's your gas level, like your benzene? What's your energy level? And I was really tired. Because we'd been sitting there looking at the death dates of scholars, trying to figure out when certain Muslim scholars in the past had died. And he loved that. I remember him just thinking, I think this is what he would really like to do, is to be a scholar. And he wants to, you know, I think he often asks himself, you know, should I drop this go back to scholarship? And you know, one of the things you say is the media is corrupting. The media is a terrible, terrible business. It's a terrible world to be in. You don't get into it and leave untainted. It will destroy you, crush you, twist you into a monster. And I think that that's always on his mind. And I think as long as somebody is aware of that, then doesn't let it happen to them, or not too much, then I suppose that's the most I can ask. And,
You know, it's interesting. You know, when I talked about this kind of this desire for being here now, and the way you're describing this person is a person who's very electric, has enormous energy, is an energy star. That is, I mean, it's all the classic traits of what a charismatic figure does. And it's interesting because you're kind of rationalizing and defending your interest and your relationship to him, which is interesting too.
Interesting.
But, you know, I kind of felt that way when I was with Rob Bell, and I kept thinking to myself, what's wrong with this guy? Is there something wrong with him? Should I not like him? And then I found myself going, no, I really like him. I want to be his friend. Yeah. Is that right? You know, and all that kind of feeling. And and a lot of people said, is he corrupt? Is he a fake? Is he a fraud? And I saw him with his family. He loves his family. Loves his wife. Loves his 3 kids. He takes care of them. He started a mega church that did more good than any church I've ever seen do, both for the poor and for those who are on the margins. What's bad about it? And then a lot of people would criticize it, and I'd say, what have you done?
Yeah.
Tell me about your life and
people
what's
like
your mission.
People love to hate, as they say. I mean,
I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, I really don't think charismatic figures are bad necessarily by any means. I think they're very powerful, they're social movement figures.
One of the interesting things about, you know, this issue of, like, is someone authentic, is, you know, is someone performing? Are they performing a role? Are they faking it? And so the interesting thing about the Ba'alawi Sufi order is that, and Sufi orders in general, is that they're, so you have to try and imitate the Prophet. And you do that consciously. You don't, I mean, it's not like you sort of breathe in some sort of faith gas and then you just act like the Prophet. You imitate the Prophet by imitating it. You sleep on the side that he slept on. You eat the way he ate. You drink the way he drank. You smile, because smiling is the Prophet would smile, and smiling is an act of charity. The way you speak like the Prophet spoke. And that's all a performance, but the idea is, and this is very Aristotelian, I mean, you perform it enough, then you become that figure.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I'll see like Habib Ali speaking, and yet I can see he's performing. But he's performing not as, I think, a media star. He's performing as, I want to act like the Prophet. I'm going to smile. I'm always going to smile, 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 smile. I'm always going to say the things the Prophet said. I'm always going to answer questions the way the Prophet answers questions. And someone can say, oh, he's just playing that part of a pious person. But that's what he does in his own life. I mean, for example, one of the sunnah, the kind of recommended things the Prophet did that Muslims don't have to do, is he would wear a hat or a turban. And in the Ba'alawi Sufi order, it's considered kind of disgraceful to not have a turban or have a hat on. And nobody's seen Habib Ali without his head covered. But I remember it was really early one morning in Yemen, and he had come from the shower, and he put his clothes on, and I went into his room in this house where we were staying, and he took one hat off. He took a hat off, brushed his hair, and immediately put this other hat back on. No one was there. It was just me and him. But he did not want to have his head uncovered for a second, except to brush his hair. And is he doing that performing for me? I think that's actually how he thinks all the time.
That's what a charismatic figure does, though. You're describing exactly what a charismatic figure does. He performs in all the appropriate ways, and he knows how to get attention. And he's gotten your attention, and you're spending a lot of time describing him, and just like I did with this Rob Belfair, you know, in terms of Christianity, it's like, how do you imitate Jesus? Because you know Jesus sort of didn't have a very successful career.
Yeah.
It wasn't a long lasting career. I thought about in terms of Islam, there's kind of an advantage to your prophet. Because he actually lived a normal life that you could.
I mean, I think that's one of the differences.
You could imitate.
You don't have, obviously, if you're found with a gay prostitute doing crystal meth with them, that's probably not going to be good for a Muslim preacher. But I mean, if you have four wives, you know, people might, in a lot of parts of the Muslim world, it's not socially acceptable to have more than one wife. In Egypt, it's really not acceptable to have more than one wife, at least in Cairo. But, you know, in Yemen, this is fine. So, you know, he doesn't, like, that kind of takes away one of the, if you have four wives and you still have energy and temptation, and you know you're still going to fall victim to some, you know, groupie. You have a lot of energy, and that's, you know, maybe, but that's rare. I mean, it is. I think there's a lot of. I think he's immune to some of those temptations because of the tradition he comes from, which is different than a tradition that is, maybe one could generalize as being more anxious about sexuality.
Christian.
Yeah, I don't want to. I mean, I would. If it's a generalization, maybe it's an accurate one.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things is that these charismatic figures, these Christian figures, you almost always find sexual problems because there's excess energy, like what you're describing, and it has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And you know, again, the advantage of a Muslim is that you can have four wives. I mean, that's very helpful if you're a highly energetic person.
Makes anniversary planning harder, though. So I don't want to take up too much time unless people have comments, questions, answers. Otherwise, we'll